Welcome to the Endurance Town USA Project. This podcast, along with our blogs and adventure team, travel around the world creating and sharing the stories of humans changing lives through endurance sports. Today, we're excited to introduce a new mini-series, Running Across America, featuring the stories of four diverse American transcontinental runners, all motivated for different reasons to run across the United States of America. We will explore the who, when, what, and why of their stories and help listeners inspire a spark deep within themselves to go discover what is possible. This is Endurance Town USA.
Bring it back. Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Samantha Pruitt from Endurance Town USA with my co-host, Shan Riggs.
Shan Riggs here.
We are both currently in isolation quarantine in Sydney, Australia, getting prepared for the 1,000 Miles to Light event. And we have a special guest today. We're super excited to talk to Marshall Ulrich, the one and the only. And so let's just go ahead and dig in, shall we? Marshall, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing well, and thank you very much for having me on your podcast, Endurance Town. And it's nice to see you again, Sean. So
thank you.
Fire away, guys. I'm an open book.
All right. Marshall, where are you located? Where are you living these days?
I am living in Evergreen, Colorado. I'm a Colorado native, and I lived in Idaho Springs at 10,000 feet. And, you know, I would spring up and do a little bit of mountaineering and stuff, and that was an ideal climate for that. But I'm at about 7,400 feet here in Evergreen, so it's very nice here.
Okay, fantastic. And so how long have you lived in Colorado? Is that where you were born and raised?
Yes. Yep.
Oh, okay. And so the nature of the outdoors and the outdoor life just was built into your upbringing and your DNA?
Well, you know, I think it was. I grew up on a dairy farm, and so I worked with animals. We went out and worked the fields, and, you know, way back in the early 60s, a lot of it was manual labor, you know, bucking bales and stuff like that. So I look at some of the endurance sports as sort of an extension of that. I just grew up doing it. And so it just seems like a natural thing to me.
Okay. A little bit of a country boy. So did you also play sports, or you just worked physical farm labor?
Well, it was physical farm labor, but then in high school, junior high, I used to wrestle. That was my main sport. And I did just dabbled in track just a little bit. And I can remember going out and, you know, running up to the bridge out of Kersey, Colorado, that was a mile and a half away. And so it was a mile and a half out and a mile and a half back. And I think that's the furthest I ever ran. And let me tell you, we thought we were really doing something back then, because nobody else did that sort of thing that we knew of anyhow.
You were teenagers, you were doing something.
That's impressive, exactly.
For a teenager.
Yeah.
So at what point in your life did you discover running for something other than training for wrestling?
Well, it wasn't until I was 28 years old, I lost my first wife to cancer, and the doctor said I had to do something to sort of lower my blood pressure. So I started running. And, you know, I stretched the distances from 5 to 6 Ks and started marathoning probably within a few months. And I really didn't get into ultra marathoning until the mid 80s and did my first 50 miler. So I discovered then that, you know, I wasn't fast enough. Take, for instance, I could run a 2:58 marathon, which is not, you know, that great. But if you stretched it out, it seemed like I could keep going. So
and going.
Yeah, I think it kind of found me more than I found it.
Yeah, well, what's amazing is you were given advice, you know, to basically heal your heart, literally, and you chose running to be the tool for that healing.
Yes, and a lot of it was just practicality, where it was very easy to just put on a pair of shoes other than, you know, getting on a bike or something like that, that involved a lot of equipment. So mm-hmm. I could get it done real early in the morning and, you know, I'd have the rest of the day. So, and you can get a lot of bang for your buck. You know, you do a 10K or something in the morning, and then that pretty well sets you up for the rest of the day. And if you continue on with it, it sets you up for just a lifestyle that is healthy. And, you know, speaking of which, you know, the mental aspect, it really did bring down my blood pressure. And so I never really had to go on medication either.
Wow, that's fantastic. Did you build a community around that? Did you find a way of community? I don't know if you have, you know, friends or family or running club or children or anything like that. You built community around running?
You know, not so much, just because, you know, it was Fort Morgan, Colorado. So there were a few runners that I bump into here and there. And sometimes I did occasionally go out with them. But it was mostly a solitary thing. And I found that, you know, very healing up to a certain extent. And as I progressed, and I think particularly when I was running across the United States, which is, you know, going to be our main topic, I found about halfway through or two thirds of the way through going across the United States that I couldn't do it alone. I needed other people's help, and I needed to communicate, and I needed to connect with them. So it was sort of an extension, and I flipped over into a different type of healing mode in that I started reaching out to other people too. So originally, you know, the first 20 years, I was all kind of hanging out there by myself. And, you know, my community was the running community, but it would be mostly like, take, for instance, I'd go out and do Badwater, and I do that on a yearly basis. And they were essentially, those people were my family.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that amazing? The power of that, right? The unity that comes in the love of a sport, but also how you understand immediately one another, because you have this shared experience of moving your body through space. You know, it's just, that's so cool, so powerful. And we want more people to be doing it, of course. So we don't want to, you know, any type of moving your body in community, to me, is, you know, it's therapy. So we need more and more of that in the world, more now than ever, don't we?
We absolutely do. I would agree 100%.
Mm-hmm. So some of your running shenanigans, I'll just call them, you went from basically running for your physical health and your mental health, obviously. And then at what point did you decide, hey, I'm running longer and longer, I should probably toe the line at a few of these ultra races?
You know, I think it happened fairly quickly. I started running in about 1978. And by 1985, I started looking around for something more than just a marathon. Once again, you know, I just wasn't the quickest or anything. And you know, I tried to be competitive, but it's pretty tough. And, you know, that was during the time, the late 70s, when, you know, Frank Shorter had already won the Olympics, and he caused a big running boom. And so, you know, it was contagious. But then, you know, about 85 or so, I started poking around, and I saw an article, I think it was in Runner's World, where someone was talking about Western States 100, and I started looking at that, and I thought, God, you know, I should go out and try that. And, you know, I don't think I was particularly intimidated by it. It was just more of a curiosity than anything. So I gave my hand a 50 miler, and, you know, was off to the races from then. And I did enjoy, you know, just seeing how far I could push myself. And it got to the point where in some of the competitions, I could actually do pretty well.
So your first 100 was at Western States?
My first 100, let me think about this. It was Western States.
Yeah, how old
it was Western State. I was 38 then. I just turned 70, by the way.
Yes. When was your birthday?
Happy birthday.
Well, it's July 4th.
Oh, okay.
So anyhow, yeah.
You're an independence baby. Happy birthday.
Yes. Thank you.
70 and you're still crushing it. I love it. So you moved from the 100 milers, and then at some point, I mean, you've worked your way through all the epic races many times, but then at some point you sort of segued into doing, you know, just self adventures and things that you just created on your own. You know, it was like the next level of Marshall would just keep evolving over time. What was that about? Or what is that about as your own development?
I, I think a lot of it was, of course, I wanted to see what I was made of, but I also felt that people underestimated what they could do. And so I wanted to kind of show them what could be done. So you're absolutely right. I think it was the early 90s. I really kind of started doing that with, take for instance, doing the Leadville 100 and then the same weekend going up and doing the Pikes Peak Marathon. You know, back-to-back stuff that people would say was crazy or quad, Pikes Peak runs. And so those were kind of the early stages. And it just kind of evolved from there. And I looked at it as more of a creative process. You know, incidentally, I have a degree in fine arts. So it sort of was an extension of that creativity where I found it kind of fun to just think up things and then put them into action for the most part, if I could anyhow. So, and sometimes I was really in over my head, believe me.
Yeah. You're still standing.
Yeah. Well, and essentially what I consider the hardest thing I did was run across the United States. Mm. And I think what made it exceptionally hard is, you go out and you do maybe 60 miles a day and then you go to bed. And what do you have to look forward to the next morning? Another 60 miles a day so you could psych yourself right out of it. So it was really a mental game, as you well know, Sean, as well as taking care of yourself. And, I had probably at that time run, I'm estimating maybe 70, 75,000 miles over the course of my career. But doing that one run across the United States, I learned more than all the adventure racing, all the mountaineering, all of the running that I'd done about myself, how to fuel myself, how to keep myself going. And of course, I was 57 also. So I was, I was kind of pushing the age there limit or I felt I was the envelope. So anyhow, it worked out well, but it was very tough.
You're making me happy because I turned 52 while I'm in quarantine here.
Yay!
I didn't really find running until I was almost 30 and ultras till like 40. So I feel like I still have so much potential and unexplored opportunity left. I mean, I don't even feel like there's a limit, right? But everybody in my age group is trying to tell me otherwise. And I'm like, oh, you're just not hanging out with the right people. I'm going to call Marshall every day. Hey, Shan, let's dig into running across the United States. You have a bunch of questions for Marshall.
Yeah, this is great, Marshall. I've read your books and I've watched that documentary of you running across the United States, and it was one of the inspirations I had. But it was interesting because when I decided I was going to run, the first thing I decided that I wasn't going to do it the way you do. I wasn't going to go for a record because I saw the extraordinary pain that you went through. While I wanted to challenge myself, I wasn't sure if I really wanted to go so far that I was going to need to go to the hospital and those things. Can you expand a little bit more on the actual physical part of it? How did that go? How did you continue on when you had things like, I forget what it was, something like a broken foot or something like that? I can't recall.
Exactly. Well, it wasn't, quite that serious, but good for you for making that decision, because that's one thing that, I would like to do eventually if I could get around to it is my wife, she was so, she fell in love with just that idea of going across the United States. So, one of my goals in the future is to get her in shape and the two of us just walk across at a slower pace and enjoy things. And I think it'd be an extraordinary experience, maybe do 30 miles a day, maybe 50K or something and cut it off there. So you feel like a human being instead of, I don't know, like a wild animal or something scared and, of defeat and whatever it is that's going through your mind. So,
But at the same time, you said that you learned some things about yourself when you did do it the way you did, where you pushed to the absolute. envelope. Can you expand on that a little more?
Well, one of the things that was so striking to me at, the age of 57, I was shocked at how slowly I went. And for the first probably 1,000 miles or so, I was beating myself up because, you know, here I am running 3 or 4 miles an hour instead of 4 or 5 miles an hour. And I'm just having to stay out there. I think I kind of average 17 to 18 hours of running per day. So, you know, I was just out there all the time and I kept thinking to myself, man, if I was just, you know, a little bit faster and, you know, 10, 15 years ago, I could have done this, and been in bed and gotten more sleep and so on and so forth. But the reality of it is that, being older, that just wasn't going to happen. But one thing I could do is I could go out there for a long period of time and accomplish the same thing. So it was sort of a mixed message that I was giving myself. On the one hand, it was very gratifying that I could go out there and do it. On the other hand, I was just beating myself up. So about at 1,000 miles, I just let it go. And I just said to myself, you know, however long I have to stay out here, that's what I have to do. And once I kind of flipped the switch in my mind, I think that helped a lot. And you speak about injuries. Well, the first 6 days, 6.5 days or 7 days, I was doing an average of 70 miles a day. And what that was doing, it was eating into the time that I had to sleep. So the first days I was doing that in, you know, maybe 14 hours. And then the next day, guess what? It was like 15. The next day it was 16 hours. Then it was 17. Then it was 23 hours. And all of a sudden it's like, I just can't keep it up. So there was no resetting the mind. There was just, you know, you can only do so much. So I came to that realization and, it was good that I did because I kind of hit the sweet spot where I could function doing maybe about 60, 62 miles a day was always my target. I did have, a few off days that were very low mileage that pulled my average down to, it almost equated to 2 marathons and a half marathon a day. So it was about 58 and a half miles, just under 60 miles per day. But, take, for instance, what was the first injury I had was in Delta, Utah. And mostly what they were foot injuries and things like that. A torn ligament on the outside of my foot or, aches and pains. I dislocated my femur when I was at about 1,500 miles and got it popped in and it was fine. So, you know, the lesson is that no matter what happens, you can problem solve. And, if you're focused enough, if you have that desire, and that's the main thing. You know, everything's off the table unless you have that burning desire to finish and do it and do it right. I think once I tapped into that, I was much better off.
That's great. And how many days, what was your final when you reached?
It was about 52 and a half days. Yeah. And it was, it was 3,063 miles. I have to look at my book title because it's like, you know, I can remember it's like 3,060. Was it 2 or 3 or 4? Really doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's great. And I have a master's record at the time and just a few days behind the all-time record at that time.
It was more than a few days. Frank Giannino held the record and that was, what was his record? 66 miles per day or something. So, yeah. So, you know, it was, and of course, Pete Kostelnik, I don't know if you guys are going to talk to him. He's a rock star. That guy is just in my book, I don't know of anybody who can, you know, keep going and do that type of mileage and things like that. And incidentally, with your 1,000-mile run, I see you have Pat Farmer, and he's my hero. That guy is so good. He is as tough as nails.
Yep, yeah, he's on the Australian team, and actually he's the coordinator, technically the event director overarching for the event. This is his dream, and we're part of his dream, and we're incredibly honored to be part of it. He is a badass, but he is also just the sweetest human being. He's so sweet.
Yeah. South Pole or hi. North Pole to South Pole. Unbelievable. I first became familiar with him when, I was going to do the run across the United States back in 91, 92, and then it fell through for me. But I believe he was part of that, too.
Yes. Yeah, I've been telling people that I'm junior league on this team because I've only crossed one continent. And I'm always telling people that no matter what you've done, there's always somebody else out there that's done something even more extraordinary. So it's a humbling sport, this adventure.
It really puts things in perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. So And Sam and I are doing these interviews somewhat in part to talk to people that across the country for sort of practical advice on how to do something like that or something even specifically, but also the part of 1,000 Miles to Light that we're raising money for is for mental health, especially this organization in Australia, Reach Out for Youth Mental Health. So wondering if you have any thoughts on that. I know that was a central theme in your most recent book.
Yeah. So, my most recent book, it came out about a year ago, just right in the midst of the pandemic, basically. And I didn't plan it at all. In fact, it took me 4 or 5 years to write it. And, I thought to myself, I'm going to make this one count because it's the last book I ever want to write. That is excruciatingly painful for me to sit down and try and write something. So it took quite some time. And then, you know, we just happened to finish it when the pandemic came out. And the message was just so tuned to that, where people were cooped up inside. They couldn't go outside. And so, I just encouraged them. You know, what's safer than being out in the environment by yourself? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you could go unmasked as long as there weren't other people that were in close proximity. And so I come up with some statistics about, how healing that is for people on the mental stage. So, I talk a lot about that, and I weave a lot of the adventures that I did in the past to sort of give an example of that, and talked about, you know, how you have to be kind to yourself, how you have to have focus, all those messages. But the most important message is to get outside and stay outside as much and as long as you can.
100%. 100%.
Yeah, I think it's a risk of people that, you know, you're told to stay inside. Here in Australia, especially, they're going through a lot of lockdowns. One of the few things they are allowed to do is go out and exercise. But I think a lot of people, they're told to stay at home, and they take that almost too literally and literally stay inside and, you know, watch Netflix all day. I think even people like me, I got here after being the first 24 hours of lockdown, I didn't have a treadmill or anything and got a little lazy and spent way too much time on the couch before I finally started moving around and figured out I could just do lunges and push-ups, and there's got to be some way to move your body. So when you're told to shelter in place or stay at home, I think there is a little bit of that risk to take that a little too literally, that there is the outside almost always, except for Sam and I and these few people that we're literally stuck inside. But for most of the world, even if you're in quote unquote lockdown, doesn't mean you can't go out and exercise and breathe some fresh air and walk around the block or you know, keep going a little further until you're, you know, out in the woods or going across the country.
Yeah, and it is kind of interesting because you can see how, you know, the technology sort of changed to almost create as close to real life situations, you know, take for instance, like your pentathlons and stuff like that. They try and create situations where you're outside and, you know, this and that. And I think that's really good, but nothing beats the real thing. And that's to get out there and, you know, if it's cold, you feel the bite of the cold and, you know, there's something to be derived from that. There's something about, it uses all of your senses. Instead of just, you know, your brain, you know, the cerebral thing that's going on.
Yeah. And there's an energy out there that is a power source. As far as I'm concerned, I always say I'm solar powered because I like the heat and I like to run through deserts and things like that. But, you know, the air, the cold, the experience of the heat, the experience of the dirt and, you know, the plant life and all of that kind of stuff, there's an energy, right? Yeah. So in a way it's like plugging yourself back into humanity when you walk out our doors and use your physical body.
Right. Yeah. I agree 100%.
Yeah. Well, Marshall knows something about heat being Mr. Badwater and spending a lot of time in Death Valley. Most of the time in the summer, but I've also was watching, looks like you spent some time in Death Valley this winter too.
Yeah, I did. It was something I'd been thinking about doing, oh, probably for a half dozen, maybe 6 or 8 years, something like that. And, you know, that was to do a winter Badwater. And of course, that doesn't sound like too much because, you know, the first 130 miles or so, you've got very temperate weather and the parameters that are set for that are the opposite of doing it in the summer. So instead of the July, August window, you have to do the January, February window. And so January, February, temperatures in Death Valley are, you know, 65 to 75, may get up to 80 degrees, but then you get on Mount Whitney and hold on to your hat or it's going to blow off. And really about the only way that you can get up the mountain, or the safest way, believe it or not, is a 6 mile route instead of the 11 mile route that goes up the Mountaineers chute. So there's a lot of snow up there. You're on crampons, you're bundled up. You've got, you know, 20 below sleeping bags. And it took me 2.5 days to get up it. And, you know, for, you know, just going up 6 miles, you go up a couple of miles. And I mean, you know, I was pretty well whipped. So you go up 2,000-3,000 feet and, you know, with the wind and cold in your face. And it was a whole different ball game. So it was good.
Well, you didn't show up there fresh. You ran from the basin, right? And then you ascended. Yeah. So you didn't show up all, you know, fresh and perky. You were already pretty well taxed. That's amazing. That's insane. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, just another, you know, something that somebody else hadn't done.
That's that creative part, like you were talking about, finding the
artistry. Artistry.
And for those that don't know, the Badwater route we're talking about is from the lowest point in North America up to the highest point in the southern contiguous up on Mount Whitney. And you were also raising money for charity in that run, correct?
Yeah, I was. So, you know, many of the people who are tuning in might have seen, it's called the World's Toughest Race, and that's, you know, the old Eco Challenge, and that's Mark Burnett, and Bear Grylls was the face of it. And so I've done a lot of adventure racing. In fact, Adrian Crane and myself are the only two in the world that have done all 10 Eco Challenge is, wow. Now that's not finishing all 10, we finished 8 of them, but we participated in, particularly in this last one, we were more participants. The average age of our team was, I believe it was 66 or maybe it was 67, something like that. So, one of my friends who, you know, that's Team Stray Dogs that we christened way back in 1995 when we started doing adventure racing. And Mark was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, early onset Alzheimer's at the age of 64, and he's 67, he's soon to be 68 years old. And he was out there doing that race, the Eco Challenge race. And the story, if you, it's on Amazon Prime, it's called The World's Toughest Race, and he's featured in it. You know, I make an appearance here and there, but, you know, it's one of those things where we talked about that. We connect with other people, and some of those people become lifelong friends. Mm-hmm. And we have a, I don't want to say duty, the pleasure of helping them through rough spots. And Mark is going through, you know, some rough spots, you know, as we speak. And so, I kind of lost my, what I was, you know, delving into and talking about. I just, go off on that. Segue, and it's it's very important to me.
Was that the nonprofit that you were doing the Winter Badwater for?
Oh well, thank you. Yeah, it was the Alzheimer's Association. So, you know, our goal was to raise $14,505, which is the height of Mount Whitney, and I think we're still, you know, getting a few, some of the donations are trickling in still, but I think we raised about 15.5 or something like that. So, cool. We met our goal and then some. So, and hats off to you guys for what you're doing too. That's what really makes it meaningful.
It does. How can people find that and donate now if they still wanted to, since the site is still open?
Well, what they should do is they can go to the Alzheimer's or they can go to, they can look on my website, you know, MarshallUlrich.com, and there should be something there. But the team that we, it was Team Endurance. Team Endure. And so we are raising money for Team Endure, and my name was associated with it. So if you, if you go on the website or something, you'll see it.
Perfect.
Marsh, do you have, obviously you've been able to do this for quite some time. Do you have any advice for people as far as how to, keep yourself at it and injury wise, mental health wise, any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people just go out and hit it day in and day out. And, you know, I used to do that too, for the most part, without taking a break. So, you can take it a little bit over the top.
Shannon's right above me in my hotel room, literally directly above me. Our treadmills are on top of each other at one floor up. And I'm like, he's dropping the hammer. I got to get back on the treadmill.
Guilty as charged.
In regards to that, there was always November, December of each year that I would pretty much take them off and I wouldn't run a step. Wow. And what it allowed me to do, I think, is it increased my longevity because everything could heal up. Mm. And I think more than anything, it was good for me mentally, because by the time I got around to January or February and really started getting back into it and ramping up my training and things, I came back fresh. And so mentally, you know, I was looking for that again. I just think it goes a long way if you can just kind of be a little bit kind to yourself here and there and treat yourself to, you know, at least I advocate taking a day off a week. I don't care what now. And I never used to say that. I go out and hammer, I try and do 12 miles a day no matter what. And then on the weekends, I do 20 to 30 miles on Saturday and the same on Sunday. So, then I think what happens is you can start neglecting things that you really should be paying attention to. And I guess that's a second part of it, that, if you can kind of step back from the running or whatever activity that you're doing and, just love so much and are so intense about, and you know, step back and reconnect with your family and friends and pay attention to the things that are really meaningful in life besides running, because we may fool ourselves and say, you know, all my life is about running. And I think for some people it may be. And for me, it was a way to survive. But if we can just step back occasionally and pay attention to, you know, smell the roses.
That's great. So obvious next step, are you planning anything new? Anything coming up in the horizon?
You know, I really don't have anything. And I say that, but, you know, it takes me a while to sort of, you know, get over what I did the last time. And like that winter crossing, it took me probably 3 or 4 weeks where I could really walk on one of my feet. My left foot was really, really bothering me. A lot of swelling. I had a lot of edema, you know, retaining water and stuff like that, and swelling and so on and so forth. And so it's like, oh man, you know, so there's no way that I could have gone out and ran. So I sort of just backed off a little bit, and I'm just now gradually going back into it. And then Mark, the person I was talking about that has Alzheimer's, him and I will go out 3 or 4 times a week, and we'll usually do 5 or 6 miles up on Evergreen Mountain. And, you know, just enjoy ourselves. But, you know, to answer your question, I really don't have anything. I had mentioned walking across the United States with my wife, you know, that would be great. I'm sure something will come up, but it has to be toned down because I just don't have the speed, and I have to be, you know, take care of my body more and more because it just doesn't recover as quickly. And, you know, I have aches and pains that I didn't used to have. And, you know, this getting old isn't for sissies, man.
That makes sense. I think I've done a little bit of the same, especially when there's something so big, it's hard to plan beyond that because you don't know what kind of shape you're going to be in at the end.
Yeah.
When I finished my USA run, and people warn me about every, I think you and other people that I talked to, everybody said, you know, plan on something, but don't get too ahead of yourself. And most people talked about feeling, kind of a bit of a letdown, which I, even though I saw it was coming and everybody warned me about it, I still felt it. So I finished on December 1st in Connecticut, and, I can tell you most of December and first part of January, I really didn't have any idea what I was going to do with myself, in part because the pandemic was still going on and my career was in turmoil. And so it was, it's something to, if people are going to do something like that or, you know, anything big, something to be aware of. I think at least being warned about it helped. But I still had to go through it, and it was helpful to kind of slowly come about to what are we going to do next.
Yeah. Well, you know, and as it speaks to, you know, I think intuitively you become a better runner and you know how to fuel yourself, you know how to keep going. And I think the same thing holds true. You know, after you finish the run, just be kind to yourself and listen to your body and give it what it needs. And maybe that's rest. And so just do it. Don't force the issue.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Marshall, I have a question for you based on all of your years of doing these adventures and really self-driven, self-motivated, self-planned and orchestrated. What are the things that you've learned the most about yourself in the course of this journey?
I think more than anything, I like to lay claim to just being an average guy, and what I've discovered, I am just a very, very average guy. And the you know, with age and everything, you know, it really drives that home. You know, and I think the other message is it's kind of a dichotomy of sorts, but, you know, you, depending upon your age and things like that, but I mean, I discovered that I could do and recover faster, do more than I'd ever dreamed of. And I think it's very interesting because take, for instance, with with bad water, I had some pretty good times out there. And I look back and it's like, who was that guy anyhow? So, you know, it seems like you almost remove yourself and step back and look at it. And it's not that I'm, you know, I'm proud of what I did, but I'm not so focused on it. I don't think that it means a whole lot to me now. It's like all the buckles and stuff that I have up at a rental house of mine that we do for VRBO. And it's interesting because it's a big trophy case and it's got, you know, gazillions of buckles. And, you know, I think I've got 4 or 5 number one bad water, wow, you know, numbers and stuff in there. It's amazing. And there's a Summit suit for Everest that's up in the attic that I leave up there with oxygen tanks. And probably 1 out of 10 of the groups that go up there actually even say anything about it. And I think to myself, it actually makes me very happy because they're probably focusing on nature and their kids and their family and having fun. And it's like, you know, why should you be impressed by anything that I've done? You know, go out and do something that sets a good example for somebody else. Yeah. So, you know, I've learned that too, not to take yourself. And what I always tell people is when you start taking yourself too seriously, or when I did, I was in trouble. Mm. If I could just, you know, not take myself seriously, then I seem to do the best.
Mm. Give yourself permission.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'll get there when I get there. I'll do the best I can do at this moment. Today, I have this day. I have this day. I don't know how it's going to go, but I have this day and I'm going to go for it.
Yeah.
Isn't that actually the story of the pandemic? I mean, to be clear, what else do we know besides this moment and the unpredictability of what we're living through right now collectively? I think it's so incredibly powerful. I think so much power can be held in that, but people are feeling really hopeless and discouraged. What do you have to say to that?
Well, I think for the most part, we like to have a certain amount of control in our lives. And, you know, I can liken it to when you're out there, you know, running across the U.S. or running a race or something like that, and something happens and it's unexpected. And so, you know, it's kind of like there's no way that we can really prepare for that unexpected, but there's so many things that are literally out of our hands that we have no control over. Mm. And, you know, if we just do the smart thing and what is, you know, and I don't say this selfishly, you know, take care of ourselves. Because when you start taking care of yourself and you're kind to yourself, then you can reach out to other people and do the same for them.
That's right.
I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some things are just out of our control. This whole pandemic is out of our control. But, you know, there's certain things that mitigate it, like, you know, I don't want to get political or anything, but immunization and stuff like that. So, you know, if there's something that's scientifically based or whatever, I mean, you know, we can kind of mitigate things a little bit. So, you know, so sorry about that. I just had to,
that's okay.
Had to kind of go on that tangent.
Yeah, well, when you think about moments for yourself on a big adventure in the middle of a hardcore race, did you ever feel hopeless? And if you did, where did you find hope? How did you turn it around?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess hopeless is the right word. You know, the example when I was running across the United States, there were 2 or 3 times where I just, you know, get into the van. There were a couple of times I just bawled, you know, I just cried. I mean, yeah, you know, I just couldn't contain myself. It's like, this is just so, so bad, so awful. And I'll use an example. It was about midway across the United States, and I can't remember exactly what town it was, but we pulled over to the side of the road and we just happened to, didn't pull over, but the RV was pulled over. And so I ran up to it. And then, you know, we looked out in a pasture and it was October 30th or something, and they were having, you know, a bunch of kids were having a big Halloween party and stuff like that, and they had trampolines and all that, and I had just stepped out of the travel trailer and I was beside myself, and I looked over and saw that, and I'm sort of integrated and mixed myself in that group of kids for about 30, 45 minutes. And it was just so joyful and everything. And it was just like osmosis that all that came into me and gave me the strength to go on. So I guess, you know, the moral of that story is you have to look for those things. And if you don't look for them, you'll miss them. So you really have to pay attention while you're out there where you're in the throes of competition or whatever. There's always something out there that will inspire you.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's a brief exchange. Sometimes it's something, you know, like that. What were you going to say, Shan?
I remember watching the documentary and reading your book about your crossing, and those moments were amazing tape. I encourage anybody to watch it. It was something where you could see raw emotion up close, and while that's something that I didn't want to go through myself during my crossing, it did make me appreciate other moments in races where I pushed myself to the limit. Sometimes you have to let yourself feel. There's going into the pain cave. There's ignoring the pain when you can, and then sometimes you just have to accept it, break down, and start back over again.
Yeah, that's a very good analogy. If you acknowledge to yourself that what you're doing is very difficult and that, you know, your life is really crappy, if you acknowledge that instead of ignore it, it allows you to move on,
right,
and let it go.
Well, there's so much energy that is required to fight it, right? So the mental fatigue, the emotional fatigue with resisting that suffering element or that pain or that, you know, emotion, that alone is draining, and you can't afford to allow that energy to be zapped, you know?
No, absolutely. No, I agree with you.
Mm-hmm. So resiliency is the other thing. Obviously you are the man of resiliency. If we look up in the dictionary, I'm sure your face is right there. And that's another thing that's been required during the pandemic, of course, you know, and every single race that you've towed the line at, or every race that anybody, or any big adventure or any big challenge in life, it doesn't have to just be an endurance sports, right? Life is full of challenges. You've had plenty of them that are outside of sport, and everybody has, you know, so resiliency is really something that we all need just to be humans in the world living this life.
Yeah, and the, you know, I think resilience, it's how we're taught. It's a learned behavior to a certain extent. And then I think there's a part of it that is maybe ingrained. It's just part of us. But I still think it's, you know, primarily learned. And I do think that if we're faced with adversity and we overcome it, I think we get better at it. I think we become more resilient.
It's a muscle that has to be worked, like every other muscle in the body.
Mm-hmm.
Shan, do you have any other questions about the crossing specifically or Marshall's experience?
I'm sure we could talk all day about some of the nitty-gritty and the stories, but this has been great. Marsh, what's the name of your latest book? I read it a few months ago, and I encourage anybody to take a look. It's very, like we were talking earlier, it's poignant and it's timely.
Yeah, so it's called Both Feet on the Ground.
You have
subtitle
a copy of it there that you can put up.
Yeah, and it's Reflections from the Outside. So if you see, there's little icons of the four elements. So what I do is I break the book down into four parts. So there's examples of air, you know, fire, water. Take, for instance, air. I tell stories about Mount Everest and dealing with that. So, you know, it's multifaceted. A lot of people, when I wrote my first book, Running on Empty, they said, but you didn't talk about Mount Everest, you didn't talk about this or that. A lot of the experiences in Death Valley, such as the self-supported circumnavigation of Death Valley, 425 miles, 16 days. You know, I talk about that a lot, you know, some of the things. So that's the fire part, of course, mm-hmm. of the book. And, you know, what you've learned, what I learned from it, you know, the lessons that what you can take away from it. So, you know, all those things. So, yeah.
Actually, that does remind me of one more question, Marsh. You've written a couple of books. You mentioned it took you some time. I think a lot of people have creative endeavors like writing a book or things like that that are so big. Any advice on how to get started, how to get into it?
Yes, please.
Yeah, it's like anything else. It's like ultra running it or running it. It looks like it's pretty easy. And then you get out there and all of a sudden you have to start taking care of yourself. You have to figure out the fueling. You have to figure out, you know, clothes and, you know, face different obstacles such as weather and so on. With the riding, I think more than anything, just like ultra running, it's getting over the fear of having to go out there and deal with something, the unknown. And so with me, it, you know, I wasn't the most stellar student in high school. I probably had a C or a D average. I just couldn't pay attention. So writing was very difficult for me, and I had to sort of relearn, you know, English, and my wife is great at editing. So what I would say to people is, you know, the best way is to just start writing short articles. And I think what is the most interesting, or what people are most interested in, is if you're perfectly honest, even though it may expose you in a way where you know that people are going to judge you. Instead of, you know, take for instance, I could have just talked about my accomplishments without having some reason for it. So, you know, be very specific and, you know, peel those onion layers mm-hmm. apart and just start small with small stories. You know, I've been writing and jotting down notes where I had, I think, over 1,000 pages of notes. And sometimes I would boil maybe 20 pages down to one paragraph. So, you know, it becomes very succinct, and it's a skill, and I certainly haven't mastered it, and I had good people helping me along the way. So that would be the other thing. If you, you know, have somebody that can, you can give your manuscript to and say, you know, take a look at this. What do you think? And be completely honest. And then if you need to ask for help from a professional, go out and get it. And I don't know what your goal is, just to self-publish or something like that. There's nothing wrong with that. Or, you know, to get it sold into a big publishing house, which is an entirely different thing. It takes a lot of sweat equity to get it done. But it's just like, you know, running 100 or 1,000 miles or whatever it is, you know, you can do it. If you have it in your mind and you have the desire to do it, as I'd said before, you can do it.
Well, congratulations. And what I appreciated about it was exactly what you just said, which it was obviously very honest and candid, and it wasn't just about accomplishments. You could really kind of get to the soul of the person. So that's very well done.
Yeah. When you were running across the United States, did you ever feel like people that were on the outside watching you? It was kind of like watching paint dry, wasn't it?
it can be. Well, I think, you know, our sport, you know, if you were to watch it live on TV, absolutely. We were talking about people running slowly in the woods. So not so great, but if you could do it, like the, I forget the producer of the Adventure Races, but like if you could tell the background and the stories, Mark, right? If you get somebody like that who can really pull out the stories of the individuals, then suddenly it's something that has a lot of, I think, interest for people. I'd love to see it. We've been watching the Olympics. I think it's time to get 100K mount or 100 mile mountain race in the sport. I'm going to show my biases, but I think it could replace race walking anytime because that one's been grinding my gears for quite some time that we've got race walking and then right before we have mountain racing. But that's me. I'm probably going to get a lot of angry race walkers.
A few nasty grams.
Well,
I think it's like seeing who can whisper the loudest. It just seems silly to me. But anyway, sorry.
I have friends who do that. Watch out. Yeah, they're going to be hitting us up. To each his own.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the 100-kilometer race would be, you know, a natural fit for the Olympics. But the coverage would be really spotty. They have long commercials and they, what people don't realize is, if you're really good at it, those guys are running really fast.
Yeah.
it's deceiving.
You can follow them with a helicopter if you get the right course, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That'd be amazing. Hey, before we close, I want to ask you one question. So, Marshall, what does endurance mean to you?
Endurance is, to me, it's perseverance, sticking with, when you put yourself out there and you say you're going to do something and it can be very, very difficult, you know, it takes a certain amount of bravery and, you know, of course, endurance is wrapped up in that too, to stick with it and follow through. And, we have to remember that we're setting an example for other people and, it may impress them, who cares, but if it has a role in their life where it betters it, just by watching you go out and do those, as slow as paint dry type endeavors or whatever, that's endurance. I think people stand up and notice if you endure pain, you endure distance, you endure whatever, it shows that what the human spirit is capable of more than anything.
That's beautiful. Well said. Thank you. Where can people find you if they want to follow your adventures, pick up your book, learn more about you, or donate to one of your causes?
Yeah, just MarshallUlrich.com.
Okay.
They can go there. And I try and update it. I think one time it was about 3 or 4 years before I updated so I'm not that good at it, but it's been updated recently, particularly because, we finished the Eco Challenge. And I have a blog there that talks about they can get enough information where they'll want to puke.
Are you on social media at all, or is that not part of your, you are?
Okay. Facebook, but I don't do so much of that. I just it doesn't mean that much to me, but every once in a while I'll chime in, and for fundraising, it's very effective.
Perfect. Shan, do you have any closing thoughts?
I think this has been great, Marsh. A lot of fun, and hopefully we'll talk to you soon.
Okay. All right.
Thank you so much for your time. It was an honor. Can't wait to see you in person one of these days, hopefully. I don't know. Shared adventure. I'm in.
Okay. Well, thank you, Samantha and Sean. I really appreciate being on the program.
Likewise.
Take care.
Take care. Talk to you soon.
Bye, guys.
Thank you for connecting with us for this episode of the Endurance Town USA Project. Discover more about today's guest, along with other great stories and video projects, by visiting us online at endurancetownusa.com. You can also follow us for updates and behind-the-scenes peeks at future episodes on Instagram at endurancetownusa. You can also connect with our creator, host, and life leadership and business coach, Samantha Pruitt, at samanthapruitt.com or on Instagram at thesamanthapruitt. And lastly, you can follow me, Travis Ford, producer and marketing creative at rockharbormarketing.com or Instagram at rockharbormarketing. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time we go on an adventure to Endurancetown, USA.
Bring it back.